announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
All right, welcome to another edition of the Filthy FRB Show. It's actually Friday now here on the East Coast. It's July 17th. Of course, I'm FRB, and I'm joined, as always, by Filthy Tom Lawler.
Yeah, actually, that's not true, Brian, because you were doing this show before I was even brought on, and you did interview Kendra Lust without me, coincidentally. You waited for the biggest female, adult film star we could get on the show, and then left me out in the cold. So it's not always me being here.
That's because you're training. And, speaking of the adult film industry, it's not next week. It's a week after that. When you're in Chicago, we're going to be talking with Nikki Benz. She actually just sent me an email tonight confirming. And so I don't know if you're familiar. Reed, are you familiar with Nikki Benz?
I am not.
And I should have introduced her. We're joined by Reed Kuhn, the author of Fightnomics. And I love this line, Fightnomics, Why There's No Such Thing as a Fair Fight. It's a very interesting book. I've had it. We were talking off air. I met Reed probably about 18 months ago, UFC 168. And I got an autographed copy of this book. And it's excellent. There's nothing like it in the MMA space. It's pretty incredible.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, you were one of the first. I was literally walking around with a special shipment of 20 that we got early from the printers. So there were a few people I had to turn down, but I didn't turn down you.
Who were those people, Reed? Can you give us some names?
Most of them were mailed out. So they were going to people in the media. A few went directly to UFC headquarters, addressed to Dana and Lorenzo. Never heard back from those guys. But yeah, it was a lot of media because we were doing the media blitz when it first came out.
So tell us a little bit about your background. It's pretty impressive. I mean, you have more degrees than Tom and I combined.
Yeah, well, I'm not even the most educated one in the family here. My wife takes that one. But a quick summary is I was a strategy consultant, a career consultant. I've done scientific consulting. I've done strategy consulting post-business school. And numbers have just sort of been on the side all along. And I stumbled into MMA as a world that did not have a whole lot of numbers yet. It turned out Fightmetric had just launched and they were in DC, which is where I was from. And just kind of everything was timed properly. And I was backstage at a UFC event with a friend of mine who sponsors some fighters, the guys from Ranger Up. And I was asking a lot of questions and no one really knew the answers to them. So I decided I would be the guy that went out and tried to figure those things out for myself. And a couple years later, I just started getting the trigger finger itchy and decided to write a book, take something off the bucket list.
So, Tom, when did you first hear about Reed and some of the statistical analysis he was doing for MMA?
Actually, it must have been, I would say, I think 2011 or 2012. I had relocated from Florida where, there's a lot of weird shit going on down there. Like, there's guys having sex with animals and there's just crazy stuff going on all over. There's people eating people on the highway in Miami.
So I was yeah.
I'm getting out of there, So I relocated close to back where I was from, in Massachusetts, to Providence, Rhode Island. And I linked up with, a phenomenal Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, Tim Burrill, who Reed had actually known before I did, I believe.
Yep.
So
he was one of those first guys I met, actually. That fateful night in Nashville where the Ranger Up crew, they were sponsoring Jorge Rivera. And I was actually leaving an older firm, going to a new company. So I was basically off for a couple months that summer and started going to UFC events with Nick Palmisano from Ranger Up. And Jorge and Tim and Matt Finney was the other corner man. They were all down there in Nashville. And we hung out and had a grand old time. And the rest is history. They're such a cool crew of guys that have been around over the years.
So that's the one in Nashville. What was that, Ellenberger and Condit? Is that the one we're talking about?
It was Campman and Condit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so I just want to get into some, general topics. Like the first thing, people are talking about it a lot is the cage size. And when I first heard about, people saying, well, you know, because I used to go to a lot of the WEC events, and I used to, you know, the cage is considerably smaller, something like 44% smaller. And I was like, well, I don't know if that leads to more knockouts, but you definitively concluded that the finish rate increases as the cage surface area increases.
Yeah, that, I think WEC was really the great testing ground for that. I mean, all those guys ended up in the UFC, so you've got the same athletes, the same rules essentially, and they also brought the matchmaker Sean Shelby over, so he is the guy still determining those fights. So in terms of a natural experiment, it's exactly what you're looking for because all the big variables are already controlled, whereas when you're looking at Pride or, you know, regional MMA, different talent, sometimes different rules, it just muddies the picture. So the WEC merger was the first hint, because when I actually went in to talk to the Fight Metric guys, and I brought up, you know, hey, have you looked at WEC stuff? And, you know, how do they finish fights? And they were like, yeah, it's weird. You know, they finish fights more often when there are not bigger guys on the card. They didn't actually, I don't think they knew that the cage size was different. And but basically what they were saying was, now that they're in the UFC, they're not finishing fights as often. Well, it was the cage. It was a conversation, I think, with Joe Silva. And he clued me into the fact that the cage size was different. So that was one of the early fun analyses that I did that clued people in that there's a big difference here. And now a lot of people are talking about it. And I do know that the matchmakers themselves are in support of using a smaller cage when they can. There are plenty of cards where there are no fighters above welterweight. And in fact, I think we just had one. And really, why not? You know, it is leading to more finishes. A lot of the fans seem to like it. Now, I know not all of the fighters like it, and there are some downsides. You can't put as many sponsor placements in there, different camera angles and such. But, you know, generally speaking, if the matchmakers want it and the fans want it, I am surprised. But we might actually start seeing it a little bit more often for fight nights.
So, Tom, what's your take on the cage size? I mean, it leads – the smaller the cage leads to more exciting finishes. As a fighter, though, you know, if I was in that position, I'm like, you're putting me in more danger and my paycheck's not increasing. I mean, is that how some of the guys feel, or is that just misguided?
Yeah, I think that's misguided. I don't ever necessarily remember any fighter bringing that up as like a point of contention. I do know that my first fight in the UFC would have been in the smaller cage, and I didn't get a finish in that fight, and it was quite boring. So I believe that I may be an anomaly in this situation.
Small sample size.
Yeah, there's also... Reed, there's go ahead. We'll stay on this cage topic. I was going to get way off topic.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I mean, I know I was recently talking with Matt Mitrione, and he's been public in saying that he does not like the small cage. He's actually fought in it five times, I think, in his UFC career, which is a lot, especially for a heavyweight, because they actually try to avoid putting heavyweights in the small cage. But he's been on some tough finale cards, and so that's usually where you see it. But he doesn't like it. And then when it came up with Machida against Romero, you could see the difference, because Machida is a guy who does a lot of circling. He stays on the outside. He moves a lot backwards. He's very evasive. And in the small cage, he just had nowhere to run. And it was just made Romero easier to catch up with him. And the same thing happened with Tim Kennedy against Rafael Nadal. Where we had a game plan in that. And what I didn't know is that Tim Kennedy had actually torn his hamstring a couple days before that, and so he was like, man, I'm so lucky that it was a small cage. I was actually able to catch him. Otherwise, I would have been chasing him around and it would have been obvious that I was limping.
Yeah, so I mean, it seems like when people are talking about the fights coming up on Twitter, the first question is, oh, what cage are they using? I mean, we pretty much know all the pay-per-views are going to be in the regular size cage. Is that correct?
Yeah, and Fox cards. They will all be in the full-size cage.
Okay, so it's the fight nights and, you know, all the other events. And I'm told, one of the fighters told me that they will tell you, like, it's not, like, they don't send out an email and say, hey, you're going to be in the small cage. But if you do specifically ask them, they will tell you.
Yeah, they probably will. And sometimes it was operational. Sometimes, you know, Ratner would punt and say, well, I'm not really sure. I haven't looked at the venue. We'll decide later on. So it is something that the ops team has to have in check, because, you know, there's a lot of planning that goes into this, and it's a separate cage that gets sent somewhere, and they have to ship them around. They don't want to send both. So they usually should know in advance. And so I think it is important for the fighters, because this came up. If you're not training for the right size cage, it's going to affect you. If you're in a smaller gym and your practice cage is small, you might find that all of a sudden you get in the big cage and you're having a lot more trouble cutting people off. So if you're not rehearsing on the right size playing field, there's going to be a difference when you get in there on game day. And that's, you know, that's just the reality of it. You want to be fully prepared for the exact situation that you're going to be in. So I think it's important for fighters to know which cage it's going to be. And it's also probably important for camps to have a full size cage and not have people practicing in something that's way too small.
Sure. Tom, at the gym that you're at, Syndicate in Las Vegas, what do they have there? Do they have a regular, the big cage, or they kind of have like a makeshift half cage just to, what are they?
It's like bathroom size and made out of chicken wire. Yeah. Actually, that's a good question. It's at least the size of the smaller UFC cage. I'm not really sure, to be honest. But there's two separate areas, and one of them is a large open space that's enclosed by the cage, and then there's a cage, you know, an octagon size cage. So, you know, it's pretty easy to get work either way.
Gotcha. So, what direction did you want to go in, Tom? Did you have something else?
Well, you know, I can't recommend Reed's book Fightnomics enough. I mean, especially for, I read a lot of stuff on Kindle, and you know, actually Reed, I believe, offered to send me a copy, and I told him like, no, you know, I'd rather buy it, because it's such a valuable resource. I don't know if you remember that, Reed, and if you don't remember it, don't look it up. I'm telling you, it's the truth.
And I didn't send you one anyway. I'm a terrible person.
No, well, I did buy it. I think I told you I was going to tell you when I bought it, but I just bought it and went about my business. But, you know, obviously I have a fight coming up very soon, and going through your book, I've looked at quite a different few markers, trying to figure out how my performance is going to go. And there's three things I've kind of singled out that left me baffled when it's coming into this next fight. The first one is, you know, the length of time I've had as a layoff. I believe you said over 1 year layoff in the cage results in about a 35% win rate for the fighter coming back, which is pretty low. Also, I am a Taurus when it comes to my athletic sign, and that win rate is below 50%. And finally, I did a few years ago, I bought this power balance bracelet to aid in my strength recovery and flexibility and just make me a better athlete. And lo and behold, in your book, you say that that doesn't work.
Yeah, so only one out of those three, I would say, is important to think about. And so layoffs resulting in slightly below average win rates can be reflective of a lot of things, but still, it's like missing weight. People, you know, it correlates with a little bit of a drop in wins, but you know, there's plenty of people missing weight and still winning. So it always really, what's more important is the root cause, and we're just getting one measured symptom of, you know, layoff time. Well, was it because there were all these severe injuries along the way? Was it, you know, recent? Missing weight is the same thing. Was there some underlying issue that led to somebody missing weight? But yeah, the astrology thing was fun to do. I actually presented that at a big conference in Vegas, the results from that analysis. And it was just to prove the point that there are things that, you know, a lot of people think might, you know, might make a difference, but lo and behold, when you actually put it to the test, there's no difference. So the fact that you mentioned Taurus is slightly below 50, the real point of that graph is to say that it's just a bumpy line around 50. It's exactly what you would expect if there was no relationship whatsoever.
Okay, that sounds a little bit like backtracking to me, but hey.
So what is it, Tom? The Taurus?
Yeah, yeah. So the astrological signs.
Oh. I got you.
Chapter in the book about that.
Yeah, there's a chapter 13, I think, is strange things that matter in MMA and a few that don't. And the things that matter, first of all, were the size of the cage actually does matter. That affects how fights are fought. No surprise there. And there was a recent research study about smiling at weigh-ins, used as a predictor of, you know, which guy of the two feels more deferential to the other. So it's more of like a status. Basically, it's a proxy for who is the more high testosterone alpha male. And generally speaking, the more aggressive guy will probably do better. It's a very slight bump, but it was found to be statistically significant. So it was a very interesting study, just because it does have psychological roots to it and they made it a testable hypothesis with watching weigh-in videos and pictures and seeing who smiled first. So smiling first is a bad thing, basically, when two guys, and I was hanging out with Seth Petruzzelli was in Virginia, and I think you were fighting on the Virginia card, and I went and hung out with him, and I said, hey, we should get a stare down picture. And sure enough, as soon as I get in that pose and doing the stare down against Seth, I immediately started smiling and laughing, and I couldn't figure out what was happening. We couldn't get a clear picture of the two of us being serious because I couldn't stop laughing. You know, that's because I was intimidated by him. He's you know, he's the more alpha male than I am. So there is some personal experience to it as well.
You say that, but clearly he must have been wearing shoes because he's got his toenails done up. He's getting pedicures all the time. He is he's quite the beta male, actually.
But I was still very much aware that he was the guy who could kick my ass and not vice versa. And so I think that's what was leading to me smiling, which is a psychological reaction to trying to diffuse any potential conflict between you and the other person.
So what is the breakdown, Kuhn? Reed, of the amount of fighters that are smiling at the weigh-in versus not smiling?
Yeah, the test was to see who smiled first. And they also had a measure of how big the smile was, if it was slight or very noticeable. And they basically took the situations where one guy clearly smiled and the other did not, and it was noticeable. And they basically took that group of fighters from all the rest. There were a whole bunch of face-offs that didn't qualify for the test. But then they looked at who won. And they basically found that, generally speaking, the guy who smiled first lost more often than the guy who didn't.
That's interesting, because I can see, yeah, you would smile to try to diffuse a situation that maybe you don't want to be in.
Yeah, and if you've been at a bar and you've seen a couple guys going nose to nose, and or some guy says something and they're kind of posturing a little bit, there's all these very particular body language signals that people give off, and right before a fight happens, certain things happen, you know, the shoulders go back, the fists get clenched, the chest comes out, and it's very animal predictive behavior. You see it in apes all the time. Apes do hand wrestling and a lot of posturing. You go check out gorillas at the zoo. It's actually pretty fascinating. I talk about that in my book, actually.
So, Tom, when you were in Chapel Hill, the home of the University of North Carolina, and you got into it with some guy at a Chipotle, Were you smiling at all? Or tell us about the incident at the Chipotle.
It was at a Qdoba.
Okay.
It was very late. And basically, some guy was picking on my friend. He was drunk and kind of passed out. And they were messing with him. So I took a bottle of hot sauce and dumped it on his head as he was sitting there. And actually, I'm pretty sure I was smiling, and he was assuredly not smiling. But I do contend that if we would have fought, I still would have won.
Did this guy look like he could handle himself, or he was just being a dick and couldn't back it up?
He looked like the kind of guy that if he's handling anything, it's definitely just himself.
I'm looking at the map, man. I used to hang out on Franklin Street all the time. Looks like the Qdoba is right there on Franklin Street, right in the Rum District.
Yeah, it was right across from top of the
Top of the hill. Yep, and yeah. The library. good late night dance. But Cosmic Cantina is where you should have been. That's the locals' insider place to get a burrito at 3 a.m.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Cadoca's not the best best spot for me at that point.
For a stat guy, Reed really knows the nightlife pretty well.
Well, I spent 2 years down there. I was at Duke, but our social life was down in Chapel Hill.
Yeah, you know, because there's Durham. I haven't been impressed when I've driven up to Durham, but Franklin Street's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And when my friend Nick Palmisano, Ranger Up guy who got me involved here, when he got married, Jorge Rivera and a couple guys were at that. Tim Burrell actually was there dressed in a Batman costume. It was a very weird wedding. It was like costumes was in the backyard. Yeah, it was wild. There were some UFC people there too. But yeah, we were at Top of the Hill for dinner one night. We definitely hit up that neighborhood. It was like a midweek wedding, weirdly enough. So things weren't busy, and it was over the summer, so the college crowd wasn't there. So it was kind of nice, actually.
Nice. So one of the things, the women's fights, you know, women's MMA is getting a lot of publicity in the UFC. And it just seems to me that almost all of these fights are going to decision. And I guess everybody has their theory. But I'm thinking, after reading your book, that it just follows along with the lower finish rate for the smaller weights. You know, I think you concluded your 25, 35, 45 is just, it's a given. It's going to have a lower finish rate than your 85, 205 hit and heavyweight. Is that why? I mean, where do the women's fights fall in compared to, say, 25 and 35 as far as finish?
They're on par with the smaller weight classes. So the women's bantamweights finish fights approximately at the same rate as men's bantamweights, featherweights, flyweights. Now, the new strawweight division may be lower. I was actually just planning to do that analysis. I was going to put an article up next week, a mid-year report, basically summarizing every single fight that's happened in 2015 through the first half of the year, as well as a bunch of other cool stats, you know, how many knockouts there's been, things like that, most popular submission, et cetera.
And where can they read you?
Most of my articles are on MMAoddsbreaker.com, and then eventually they all end up at Fightnomics.com. So I also write for ESPN. I do ESPN MMA Live every week. So those are usually video, and then I occasionally do some articles for them as well. But most of it is Oddsbreaker, MMAoddsbreaker.com, and then eventually Fightnomics.com.
Cool. So
anyway, to answer that question is, I don't know. The bantamweights were kind of in the same ballpark. They weren't really different. The strawweights, there's only been about 50 fights. No, that sounds like too much. Half that, maybe. 25. I think I was looking at fighter instances. There's going to be an article, I think, up tomorrow summarizing the women's strawweight division in terms of performance and how, you know, how good Joanna Jędrzejczyk is compared to everybody else. She's just killing it. But in doing that, I was looking up, so they've only had 3 knockouts in that division to date. And 2 of them are from Jędrzejczyk, and those were standing TKOs. So there's not a lot of knockouts in that division. They are far and away the lightest division. So the simple physics of the situation is that, in a collision, mass, momentum is conserved. So just how big you are, impacts how hard you can punch. It's that simple. So being able to take a punch is a lot easier as a strawweight, because it's just not going to be as hard. Now, there's some other things at work there. You know, when it comes to avoiding a knockout, it's all about clean health history, not having taken previous concussions, and also your neck strength. Some interesting studies have shown that if you have much stronger neck, you will not be knocked out as easily or suffer a concussion as easily. They're trying to roll that out in college football now. But anyway, getting off topic, the women's strawweights will probably have a slightly lower finish rate. But there is a whole group that sort of, they're about the same, below welterweight, basically.
Yeah. Reed, I have a question for you. You know, as a big fan of mixed martial arts, have you ever had a choke applied to you?
I have. So Mario Yamasaki put me to sleep once when I was hanging out with Tim Burrell at one of the UFCs in Philadelphia. I think I've been to 2 there, and I can't remember which one it was. But we ended up at on Friday night at a nightclub hosted by a big UFC fan, Gary G. He still texts me every now and then, pictures of him and Iceman. And Lorenzo Fertitta had a little VIP area with some nice liquor. And we just, I think, outstayed everybody else. And the last thing I knew was, hey, it's Yamasaki, me and a couple friends, Tim Burrell, and the owner of the club. And we just kept it going until like 4 in the morning. And at some point, Yamasaki was telling me, how can I write about this sport and have an opinion about the sport if I've never even been choked out? So he did a little choke. I sat in front of a chair. He wasn't paying attention. I went right out, landed in the chair. Tim jumped in to wave him off.
Wow, 4 a.m., Reed. I mean, you're a wild man.
Well, you know, it's not every day I get to attend a UFC event, so usually my, you know, the night gets the better of me, and I just want to hang out and stay up and talk with people. It's usually interesting things happen after midnight, dangerous things too, but we were pretty safe. I had Tim with me to walk back to my hotel, and Yamasaki, you know, if any ruffians about had found us on that walk through the bad part of town in Philadelphia, we would have been okay, I think.
Yeah, Philadelphia's rough, man. I was there for UFC 101, and that subway, and then you go back, what is that, South Philly, where all the arena is? And there was a guy on a motorcycle. We're walking outside of UFC 101, going back to the subway. Guy on a motorcycle starts mouthing off to some fan who's walking by. The fan walks up to the guy on the motorcycle, picks him up by the neck, and throws him off the fucking motorcycle. The guy who got thrown off the motorcycle gets back on his bike and gets the fuck out of there as quickly as possible. I'm standing there watching. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
Man, the Philly event, the first Philly event I went to, had a brawl that lasted the better part of a full round.
Yeah, that's UFC 101. Isn't that the infamous... kick, what do they say, Tom? Kick his ass, Seabass?
Yeah, that's from Dumb and Dumber.
I know exactly what you're talking about, Reed. I can't remember the fight, but you're right. They were popping the entire round.
Yeah, because I was on the opposite side of the stadium, but you could see it going on. And it was probably during like one of the middle fights, late prelims before the main card. But sure enough, I mean, the crowd started, it was in the middle of a kind of slow fight, it was quiet, and then everybody starts cheering, and nothing new is happening in the cage, and we're all looking around trying to figure out what's going on, like, why is everybody cheering? And then, like, lights were kind of zeroing in on the portion of the audience, like, oh my gosh, there's just a full-on brawl going on, and it lasted, because they were kind of in the middle, I think, of the seats, and so it just took longer for security to get to them.
Reed, not to interrupt, but it was Aaron Riley versus the guy Nelson from Hawaii. Is it Shane Nelson?
Sugar Shane Nelson, who was on the Ultimate Fighter with me. Yeah.
It was during that fight. I just looked it up. And it's on YouTube, so if you put in UFC 101 brawl, you got to look at it. I mean, it's right up there with the one from UFC 103 in Dallas, where a guy goes all the way. He gets thrown. I think he tries to punch a cop, and then he gets thrown right down the lower bowl, all the way down, like almost, you know, cage side. Like the guy's like surfing down. You know, you can Google that one too. But man, those crowds were rowdy.
Yeah, Philly's my kind of place, Brian. You know, our mutual friend, Papa Rhino. He used to hang out in Philly quite a bit, and I would go up there and visit him, and Philly's like, that place is right up my alley. It's just scummy enough that it's perfect for me.
Home of ECW. I bet Reed hasn't done any stats on ECW.
I have not, no.
Do you watch pro wrestling, Reed?
I do not, no.
No, you're far too smart for that stuff. You have all these degrees, and you can't waste your time with things like professional wrestling.
I have hard enough time keeping up with the UFC schedule these days. I don't know where I would find the bandwidth.
Oh, it's impossible, man. I mean, I can't even imagine. And this isn't your full-time gig, right? This is like...
At the moment, this is mostly what I'm doing. My wife just finished med school, so... we moved across the country, and I actually quit my job in anticipation of it to write the book. So at the moment, actually, I'm mostly doing MMA stuff. I do some other consulting work. And now that I'm actually settled in Silicon Valley, we've only been here a month. I'm actually, a lot of the startups are popping out of the woodwork. There's a startup idea that I helped found. So things might get interesting here before too long. It's hard to be in a place like this where there's so much going on and people are looking at me like, you know, what? You're writing MMA articles? You could be, you know, going work at Google or something. So we'll see how long I can focus mostly on MMA. I feel like it'll still be a hobby, especially on the analytics side. It's actually a lot of fun to just crunch numbers and pop out interesting graphs and share with people. So I'll be doing some MMA for a while, I think.
Reed, is by chance the name of your startup, or is it focused on like being a self-sustaining scallop farm?
No, that is not what I'm looking at.
Is it Holy Shirts and Pants?
Holy Shirts and Pants. Nope, that's actually not it.
Okay. Apparently, my inside jokes are not being thought, so.
I didn't get them.
They're from Wedding Crashers.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Now I can see Wilson saying that. It was him, or was it Vince Vaughn?
What does it matter?
Well, now next time that's on TV, I'm going to be watching for that.
It's lost. It's lost in the ether.
Yeah. I don't know. I also have an app from my past, which actually is what a lot of the people that work at the UFC know me by. There's actually a funny picture of me posing with Bruce Buffer with my app. And don't judge until I fully explain the history of this thing. But I created the world's first sexual position choreographer app.
What?
So you can actually build a playlist of sex positions, and it will, you know, with timers, and it calls out to you and tells you what to switch to. So you can randomize it or build a playlist or recreate famous movie sex scenes, stuff like that. So that's also a startup that now that I'm in app land, people are like, oh, you know, we could do something with that.
Reed, I mean, this is amazing, man. I thought you were just some stat geek, and now you're Mr. Nightlife. You're making apps about sexual positions. I mean, you're a playboy there.
No, it was scientific.
Okay.
Fully just scientific intentions. We wanted to help make the world a better place by improving people's sex lives. That's all. No, actually, the history behind that is actually pretty funny. So I have an uncle who back in the 70s got a patent on bed sheets that have hand and foot prints on them that are numbered and color-coded. So it was basically like adult Twister bed sheets. And they sold a few of these things. This was before the internet, obviously. And he was a successful commercial real estate guy, and they're selling these things out of his garage. He and a few neighbors got together, pitched in money, and got like 1,000 of these things printed. And I was out visiting him. He's retired now. And I had my iPhone. I had just gotten my first iPhone. This is years ago. And he's telling me this story. He's like, if I have one regret, it's not selling more of those sex sheets. And I was like, hey, you know, if you have a brilliant idea these days, you should make an app for it. He was like, hey, patent expired. Go ahead, knock yourself out. I dare you. I was like, oh, well, if you dare me. So flight home, I designed the whole thing, found an artist, found a developer, and we got Dr. Sexy Time into the app store. And so, then it's been there for years, and then it just got pulled down like last week by Google. It's been in the Apple App Store forever, and it was also in Google, but they pulled it down for some reason, so we're having to resubmit it with less interesting visuals.
And this is the one, it's listed under Calvert Strategies.
Yes. Did you just look it up?
Yeah.
Dr. Sexy Time, $2.99.
Yeah.
And it was heavily, the idea for that was conceived during the time, no pun intended there, during the time that I was hanging out with a lot of UFC people. And so there were some parts of the UFC family that had input into that, into some of the ideas. And in fact, the wife of someone in the MMA industry is one of the voices on the app. There's a few different voices that you can toggle between. So it was pretty funny. There are lots of times that we were talking about it after UFC events. Of course, you know, all these high testosterone fighters love the idea. Not that they need another reason.
Yeah. Were any of the ring card girls involved in the creation of this app?
No. Although the one time I guess I was talking to someone who was a ring card girl, I didn't realize that that's who she was. It was right after an event. I just heard the intro song play. Tom, did you just download it?
Yeah. I may or may not be acting it out as this show goes on.
So we were at an event, and some of the guys said, you know, tell us something interesting, because I read like 15 books on evolutionary biology and psychology and sex and all this stuff, because we had medical input, physical therapist input, we had a PhD sociologist design some homework assignments for the app. We definitely, you know, put a lot of cool stuff into it. But ultimately, when you're hanging out at the after party, someone's like, hey, let's see if we can try some of these crazy positions out. And everybody's fully clothed. But sure enough, one of the girls was like, sure, I'll do it. This other guy's like, you know, black belt in jiu-jitsu. He was like, all right, let's see if we can figure some of these out. And they were acting out some of these like at a bar. It's pretty funny.
Wow, we've gone completely off the rails here, huh, Tom?
Yeah, but I'm not complaining. As you can imagine, I need all the help I can get in this world. So, I think Dr. Sexy Time might be my new best friend.
That's amazing. I never knew that you had this app.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes for a very interesting conversation starter in groups. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. I can imagine now, but like you work with a lot of fighters and you probably can't disclose, you know, the specific names, but how does a guy, like, does a fighter or does his manager come to you and say, hey, we want to hire you as a consultant for this fight, and like, how do you sell them on it, or do you have to sell them on it? They just come to you and say, hey, we want reports.
Yeah, the first time was more of a just, hey, we saw this report that you did, can you do more of them? It was actually, so Jorge Rivera was kind of my test customer, given that I was hanging out with him when I first started getting involved in the UFC. And he had a big fight coming up against Nate Quarry. And I had just gotten access to the data. And so I did this massive report. I mean, it was huge. I was looking at macro indicators like reach and stance and all that kind of stuff, but also specifics about both of them and comparing them to averages and saying, okay, here's where he excels and is, or here's where he's vulnerable. Here's how, you know, let your coaches know to see if you can exploit that. So that report, we were at the fight, and I was talking to a producer for the UFC the night before the fight, and he was like, okay, smart guy, like, what's your prediction? And I said, you know, Jorge by TKO, second round. And he was the underdog, I think, in that fight. But that's actually how he won by TKO in the second round. Smashed Quarry's face. Actually, that was the last time Nate Quarry ever fought. So it was a crazy fight. And now, if I was wrong, it wouldn't mean that, you know, the analysis was bad. I just kind of got lucky on that. But I think it was his manager, Jorge's manager was new at the time, and they got a copy of it and they were like, this is actually pretty cool. So we're going to give you a test run. We want you to, you know, tell us what you think about Rashad Evans versus Rampage Jackson. You know, go out to Vegas, meet us there. We're founding a sports management company with MC Hammer. And so I went out there, and sure enough, the fight went exactly as the report said it would. Again, kind of lucky, you know, if it had been over in 10 seconds, some craziness, you know, it's not that we were wrong. It's just, you know, that's what we call variance in the industry. Crazy things do happen. You're just trying to describe the most likely outcome and, you know, put probabilities to things. And so then I got involved with Alchemist Management, and that's that was a larger group early on. They've since leaned down to just management. But I was doing lots of reports for them for over a year, and it was kind of running me a little bit ragged. I was working full time, doing this at night and all the weekends. So I took a step back from that before I decided to write the book, and I thought that might be a better way to share some of these insights with the larger fan base.
Yeah, Reed, are there any fights like where you've done the analysis and been just, you know, 100% sure that the fight's going to turn out one way? And then, you know, obviously there's a big, like you said, there's variance. There's a big surprise. Are there any that stand out in your mind?
Mark Hunt versus Bigfoot Silva. How that went five rounds, I have no idea. Those two guys, they hit hard. I thought they were also somewhat vulnerable. And heavyweight fights don't normally go the distance, especially five rounds. I think it had only happened a couple times in title fights. So that one was like, man, you know, all the evidence supports the fact that someone's going to get knocked out here, but yet they went toe to toe. I think at some point they exhausted each other out, so they weren't hitting full force. But yeah, it does happen every now and then. Something like that does happen.
Now, also, and this is like very strange to me, but looking at the UFC rankings for the top 15 at heavyweight, you know, obviously we have these guys later in their careers in their mid to late 30s having these big career resurgences. Andrei Arlovsky, Frank Mir obviously is on the mind because of last night's performance. And there's only one guy in that weight class in the top 15 under the age of 30, and that's Stefan Struve. You know, is there anything that you can kind of like glean from that? I mean, I don't know how to look at that division anymore. You know,
yeah, so the heavyweights are different. They are inherently different than everybody else because, first of all, they're on one extreme of the size distribution. If you think of the male population that could become cage fighters, they're centered right around where lightweight or welterweight would be. And, of course, those are the largest divisions. And good athletes that are big tend to go into football, basketball, you know, team sports like that, whereas good athletes who are small go into more individual sports like wrestling. So you got a lot more people that are UFC caliber athletes that want to be professional fighters in the smaller weight classes, whereas they're just simply, statistically speaking, there are not many guys who are 6'3", 250 pounds. And if they're and also never went into football or something like that. So you're talking about a small group to begin with. And yeah, their average age is the highest of any weight class. It actually it goes up kind of fairly stable way. And I think I don't fully have an answer as to why that is. I think it starts with the fact that you're just talking about a smaller group of people. And Frank Mir, I mean, we emailed each other the other night, right? We got that one right.
Yeah.
You had predicted Mir, right?
Yeah. 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 He was close to a 2-1 dog. But I was like, listen, his hands are sharper and people know that Duffy is powerful, but he also got dropped against Russo with only a few punches having been landed and he went down. So it's on paper, it was supporting Frank Mir for the upset. So, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised either way again, but you know, I was on Mir there.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. I mean, Duffy got a little crazy. I was like, wow, he really came to throw leather.
He came to hit a tennis forehand at the end is what he went to do.
Yeah. I mean, I'm obviously no MMA coach, but I don't think you're supposed to try to hit somebody like the way he was trying to hit them.
Yeah, that was a wide swing.
Who did you predict, Brian?
I picked Duffy.
I know you did. That's why I asked.
Yeah. And, you know, that's why, you know, I don't make much money betting on these things.
Yeah. Well, me neither. I don't make any, so.
What?
we're in the same boat.
I guess what I mean is I lose money.
Yeah.
Maybe if I listened to or got some picks from Reed, not that he's in that business, but some of his information would be pertinent to the outcomes of some of these matchups.
Yeah. The heavyweight thing, to me, it goes against conventional wisdom that these guys are getting more, they're developing this power or they're getting more wins as they age, because everything would tell you that in a division that's based heavily on power, right, that the more hits you take, the older you get, the less hits you're going to be able to sustain in a fight. But yet it seems like, you know, these guys are able to weather the storm and win. And I don't know, the whole heavyweight division is just blowing my mind right now.
So one point about that is there might be an increased selection process, a self-selecting or a filter, because you're right, it is all about power. And getting knocked out easily, if you have a predisposition, which you can have a genetically, they call it the knockout gene. It also predisposes you to early onset Alzheimer's. But people can be genetically predisposed to having easy concussions. And if you're one of those people, you're going to get filtered out of the heavyweight division right out of the gates, I assure you, because those first few punches, you're not going to be able to take them. So as extreme as the selection process is in MMA, you're basically filtering only the most rugged and durable athletes who can actually take damage. Heavyweights also don't fight as frequently. So they're a more valuable asset to the UFC for a lot of reasons. But, you know, why the current UFC division is old is strange.
And, you know, Reed, there's that old saying, the last thing to go in a fighter is his power. I remember first hearing that when George Foreman was in his mid-40s. And, you know, yep. He's fighting Holyfield. Of course, he fought Tommy Morrison and also Michael Moore. And, you know, I didn't know anything. I was
Brian, he fought the filmmaker.
The what?
He fought the filmmaker, the guy from Sicko and
Michael Moore. Tommy Morrison?
No, Michael Moore.
Oh, that jabroni. No, Michael Moore. The former heavyweight champion, the guy, remember he knocked him out with one punch, George Foreman did?
Yeah, Michael Moore kind of looks like Virgil, actually, your buddy.
Yeah, and you know, actually, I don't know if you're familiar with him, Reed, but Virgil is coming on the podcast. I don't know exactly what day, but it's confirmed. Do you know about Virgil?
I don't.
The Million Dollar Man's old butler.
So, Reed, Virgil, to make a long story short, there's this guy, Sam Roberts, in New York. He's a radio show host, and he used to work with Opie and Anthony, you know, before Anthony got fired for, you know, saying some racial things about some woman that assaulted him in New York City. I'm not sure if you remember that.
Okay. Yeah. I remember those guys.
Yeah, so they don't have Opie and Anthony anymore. So Sam is kind of like is part of that show, or used to be. And Sam started this website called LonelyVirgil.net. And basically all it is a series of pictures that shows Virgil at autograph conventions, and there's nobody there to get his autograph. He even set up an autograph table in a New York City subway, and nobody is there getting his autograph.
And who is Virgil?
Virgil is a former professional wrestler. He used to be the bodyguard for the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase.
Okay. So in the movie The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, there's some scenes where he's at these, you know, little halls trying to sell autographs and falling asleep in his chair.
It's along those lines, but Virgil is a special breed because he's a con artist. Like, he'll start talking to fans and he'll only tell you how much the autograph is after you get the autograph or after you take the picture. And then it'll be like, that's $50, brother. And the kid, or you know, the Mark, the fan, is just like, what are you talking about? What? So the guy's just a con artist, and we're gonna take him to the woodshed. It might get heated, Tom.
Yeah, I think he's. I don't know if he's more or less credible than the Power Balance bracelets, Reed.
Ooh, boy,
he's like the Power Balance bracelets for human. You know.
Yeah, but I just Googled, you know, he looks like he might be able to kick someone's ass, whereas a hologram sticker on a piece of plastic that costs 10 cents to make is not going to do anything.
Yeah, Virgil, he's 55 years old. He's in good shape, but so I don't know what day that's going to come out, but I'm really looking forward to that one because, I mean, everyone's like, all you do is make fun of Virgil. Why did he decide to come on the show? Well, we'll talk about it. But you know, Reed, just kind of the other thing that I had for you that I was interested, you did a statistical breakdown of just how rare 10-8 rounds are, and I guess even more rare than that is 10-10 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So is the trend getting, are we getting more of these types of rounds, or are they getting even more rare, or is that something you haven't really ran since you published a book?
Ooh, I haven't run that one lately. One of the things I look at is the rate of split decisions, just to see how much disagreement there is. And I know that at least when I wrote the book, disagreement among judges was on the up. Now I haven't checked that lately, although that's one of the calculations I do when I'm looking at a, you know, year-end report or a half-year report. But in terms of 10-8 rounds, you're right. They're really rare. They almost never happen, at least on paper. And I think that's wrong. I mean, I think plenty of times you see a round that looks completely lopsided, and yet the judges just give it 10-9 because I think it just draws less attention. But yeah, you know, with scoring and judges, I really do think they should do a better job of putting it all out there, actually talking about scores afterwards. Why did one judge score it one way and the other guy saw it the other way? Because there is disagreement in fights that go to a decision. There is at least one judge that disagreed with someone on at least one round in the majority of all fights. So it's the norm that judges watching the same fight can't agree on who won each of the three rounds. And that's something that they should do some root cause analysis and figure it out.
You know, I have the answer to that. Reed, have you ever had the pleasure of meeting the infamous Douglas Crosby?
I have not, no.
Ask him. He's a judging genius. Just ask him. Yeah. Okay. He might have, Tom, have you met him?
No, but I have some stuff to add about this judging thing when you're done. So
go ahead. I was just hoping one of you knew him, and he's a funny guy.
So okay, I am actually one of the few people, probably one of the very few, who's had a fight scored with a 10-8 round and a 10-10 round in the same fight. So you know, wow. I'm a statistical anomaly there. Now, also,
but that was because of Blatnick, right?
No, it was because of me.
He didn't do. He wasn't judging that fight.
Him. Yeah, he was the judge, but he didn't. But listen,
my point is, Blatnick actually did his job correctly. He wasn't one of these guys. He would actually do a 10-10. He would do a 10-8. He wasn't one of these zombies who just, you know, picked one side or the other.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, I sat in on the judging course for Virginia, for the Virginia Athletic Commission. And I was flat out told by the person running the course, this is what they said. He said, if a judge scores it 10-10, he did not do his job. And I'm like thinking to myself, you're an idiot. It's not up to the judge to like determine what happened in the round. What happens in the round determines the scores, you know?
Exactly.
So, I mean, to me, that was one of the worst things I had ever heard.
Well, didn't Kaiser, wasn't he the guy who said, well, I can pick anybody off the street to come up with a 10-10 round? And that's why you earn your money by determining who won?
But the judge should not be determining who wins the fight. What happens in that fight should determine the score. It's, you know...
Yeah, it's a lack of exception handling. You have to be able to go into this and say there will probably be instances where it was dead even. You know, two guys, neither of them did anything big. It was back and forth. They matched each other in terms of pace and cage control and effective striking and grappling. Neither one of them had the advantage. It is therefore a tie for that round. And plenty of times it's lopsided, but they hesitate to do the 10-8 because I think the threat of having a draw is bad press for the promotion and for the judges themselves, because maybe that mentality, like how could they not figure out who won the fight? But there should be ties every now and then. There are guys who are evenly matched. There is going to be the occasional fight that is a dead heat, and picking a winner arbitrarily is worse than crediting the fact that it was a tie.
Yeah, you can have a World Cup soccer match end in a tie, but you can't have a UFC fight end in a tie. I mean.
I think Tom, the reluctance to score 10-8s and 10-10s is because you're only working with three rounds. You know, in boxing, you're working with 10 rounds and 12 rounds. So I've often wondered, would it be better maybe to do 5 3-minute rounds?
Oh, God. Okay, there's going to be like zero grappling action in a 5 3-minute round. It's already at the point where once the fight hits the ground – and, you know, there's a lot of this stuff's covered in Reed's book. You know, there's been a statistical decline of submissions over time. And, you know, with 5 3-minute rounds, that would happen even more. You know, you would just have guys waiting it out for a minute. And, you know, the only person that would be getting submissions would be Vinny Magalhaes, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so that the reason why submissions are becoming more rare, why is that? Because – everybody's learned jiu-jitsu, everyone's just caught up, or is there something else in place?
It's two things. So first, yeah, there's been competitive forces that forced everybody to have at least a ground game. Back in the day, every fight was finished because complete styles mismatches. Someone was going to get the other guy in his world and finish him. And plenty of people didn't know how to defend submissions. Now, over time, that corrected itself. You know, that was a market correction. There was an inefficiency in the system, and it got competed away. But now, you've also got this issue that fights aren't on the ground as long. That number has been declining for a long, long time. Fights aren't spending as much time on the ground. Now, part of it is referees are intervening and, you know, telling them to press the action and doing stand-ups. guys also know are training how to get up once they're on the ground. But the fact is there is just less grappling going on. So that's why you see fewer submissions.
Yeah. And in your book, Reed, I believe that the statistics show and the data shows that there's only one submission that, you know, goes up in probability as time goes by, and that's the triangle. And, you know, I believe that you attributed that to the fact that the legs are larger muscles. You know, they don't tire as quickly. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, so that analysis was basically within a single fight, are certain submissions more or less successful as the fight goes on? And what we found was that arm locks and even most chokes go, the success rate for those go down if you're in the second or third round. So submissions are most successful in the first round, and some of that is, part of that effect is selection, because if you're going to submit someone and you're better than they are, you're going to get them on the first try, and that's going to come in the first round. But when the first submissions were attempted later in the fight, they were also less successful. So your arms will get burned out very quickly, and a submission is very different from a muscular standpoint than a strike. A strike is fast twitch. Anybody can snap that arm one more time, even if they're exhausted. But holding something, you know, when you're exhausted, pick up a weight and try to hold it out. It's extremely hard. That is a different type of muscle that's performing that action. Squeezing things is a lot harder when you're fatigued. So the one submission that popped up that actually the success rate went up instead of down was the leg triangle. So first of all, your legs have much better cardio than your arms do. And secondly, you're able to pull it off with, I think, less muscle action. It's more of a position hold. So the fact that you just see more leg triangles late in fights, and because your opponent now is also tired and they can't defend as well, a leg triangle. So that was a really interesting finding, because that's actually actionable. You know, if you like going for guillotines, once you get to round two, round three, or going for arm bars, you know, guys get really slick and sweaty, and it is hard to pull off an arm bar in the third round after you've been fighting for 14 minutes. So, you know, if you're on top, are you going to give up top control to go for an arm bar when it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to pull it off just because the guy's going to be slippery and you're not at your strongest? So maybe you should make different tactical decisions. So these are actionable insights that come from the data.
Yeah. Another one that really, you know, caught me not off guard, I would say, but it was very interesting, is that the difference. So if somebody has an advantage in height, but they don't have a reach advantage, they're more likely to be knocked out or lose in the fight, which is kind of strange to me.
Yeah, basically, it was that height is not an advantage in and of itself. It's not that they're going to be more likely to lose. I mean, they came out with a slightly lower win probability, but it was really tiny. But the more interesting thing is that when they read the tail of the tape on TV, they say, you know, this guy has a 2-inch height advantage. Well, being taller is not an advantage unless, you know, by definition, the taller you are, the more likely you are to have a longer wingspan. Those two things correlate very, very closely. But people come in all different shapes and sizes. So it's possible to be the shorter guy but have longer arms, or to be taller but not have a reach advantage. So that's the most important thing, is having a reach advantage, not a height difference, and that's not an advantage, because one of the things that you can't control in terms of your mass are your bones. And if you're 6 inches taller, you simply have more bone mass in your body that you can't cut water weight from your bones. So you're going in at a disadvantage compared to the other guy who more of his body is spent on muscles rather than bones. So there's a couple ways that that difference actually works.
The statistics in your other app, Dr. Sexy Time, also shows that people come in all different shapes. There's a direct correlation between the two sources of data there.
Yeah, you know, I read a lot of evolutionary biology books before both writing the book and creating that app. Oh, and one that actually crosses over is the testosterone test. So I used to do this at UFC events when we were out at the dinner, like after weigh-ins. We had a whole bunch of the guy, like the fighters as well as their cornermen who train with them. So Tom, look at your right hand and extend your fingers. Extend your fingers in such a way as not like you're stretching them out separate from each other, like as if you're going to shake someone's hand.
Okay, and yeah. Let me tell you right now. I've broken this hand, and it's like an inch shorter than my left hand.
The hand itself?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm just talking about the ratio of your index finger to your ring finger.
Okay, got it.
So average for men is basically that they're about the same length, maybe slightly shorter on the index finger. But higher prenatal testosterone exposure results in a shorter index finger. So fighters and high-level athletes in general tend to be higher testosterone, and they tend to have shorter index fingers. So it's a visual way of immediately identifying someone who probably has a higher upside for sports.
So the index finger is longer than the ring finger?
Shorter in high testosterone males.
Well, mine is longer.
Your index finger?
Correct.
Okay.
Looks like mine's dead even. What does even mean?
Yeah, even is about average.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised by that, Tom.
Well, like
you
I said,
you are truly anomalous.
Yeah, this hand has been broken, but it's,
yeah, that could screw it up. I don't know.
Well, it was the middle finger that was broken, so I'm not sure the other two have been touched whatsoever. But you know, on the flip side, you know, there's like a correlation between hand size and penis length as well, right?
No, actually, there isn't. Someone did test that, and they, in terms of anthropometrics, basic human body measurements, the only thing that had a positive correlation was height. So taller people do tend to have slightly longer penises. So there you go. I have read that study too.
Well, you know, that's interesting, Tom, because, you know, the aforementioned Virgil, he claims to have a 14.5-inch penis.
Yeah, I don't buy that for a second.
I mean, I don't know. Do you think...
Ask him if his index finger is shorter than his ring finger.
Like, I don't know. How do I... I mean, I think we
have
need
him, have him take a picture of his hand.
Reed, now that you talk about that, I had read that that's like one of the markers for being able to spot a transsexual. It would make sense that that would be the case, you know?
Gay men do tend to have higher prenatal testosterone. So shorter finger does correlate with that, especially with women, actually. Gay women do tend to be have the shorter finger. It also, I mean, lots of studies have been done. It's called the D2-D4 digit test, digit 2-digit 4 ratio test. And there's all these different papers on it. It's still a little bit controversial because it's you're using that as a proxy for overall testosterone, because there's obviously people that are very high testosterone. There's people that are normal and much lower. Having the high testosterone also correlates with more likely to be arrested for a violent crime, more likely to cheat on their spouse. There's all these different studies that have been done.
Yeah. I'm not surprised that the test that determines this stuff is the R2-D2 test, because his buddy C-3PO has been accused of being a homosexual pretty much throughout his entire existence.
Well, touch it. Although he was just on the cover of a magazine with Amy Schumer, and they're in bed with R2-D2, actually.
And C-3PO, R2-D2, and Amy Schumer?
Yeah, it's pretty suggestive. Very suggestive. Google that. I think it just came out. It was trending, I think, today.
I'm not going to Google that. That's not what I'm into, you know, especially not with Dr. Sexy Time on my phone now. I think it's going to – I don't need that to ramp me up.
So, Reed, where can people find you? The website, the Twitter, and plug the app again.
Yeah. I'm on the web, fightnomics.com, on Twitter, @fightnomics. And I'm writing for ESPN. I do insider pieces on betting. I also just do weekly matchup analysis with Brett Okamoto on MMA Live. And Yeah, and the app is Dr. Sexy Time. If you're interested, that's usually been an interesting talking point at the UFC weekends to get people looking at positions and reading some of the facts and homework assignments is pretty funny. So Dr. Sexy Time, it's definitely on iOS for iPhones. It was on Google. It will be hopefully back up in the store after we get over this little bump in the road that happened within a couple weeks.
And you can get the book on Amazon and also your website. Is that right?
Yeah. So my publisher will actually, if you buy it off eBay, it'll come directly from the publisher. There's some copies on Amazon also, I think. And it's the digital form is out there too. So that Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble, all the different ebook, different formats. I don't even know all of them, but if you use ebooks, you can definitely find it on your chosen store.
Yeah. Hey guys, if you're listening to this podcast, I mean, this book's phenomenal. You know, I'm a big time Kindle reader, and this is one that I can go back to over and over. It's great because it doesn't have to be like a front to back page read either. You can kind of use it as a manual or as a guide and look up different things that stand alone. You know, it's standalone statistics. It doesn't have to be. You don't have to sit down and read the thing from front to back. So it's a great resource for myself. And Reed, I got a question for you. Any predictions for the upcoming prelim main event of UFC on Fox 16 in Chicago?
I think I like my man Tom Lawler to grind down Gian Vellante on that one.
All right. Hey, so
now are you saying that because you like Tom, or is that what the data says?
Well, I don't want to reveal too much.
Okay,
but
I got you.
You know,
okay. Brian, the data says I'm going to lose because I'm a Taurus. I'm coming off
not predictive,
and I have the power balance bracelet on. So.
Yeah, also not predictive. Maybe the placebo effect actually might even help you.
All right. So that's the Filthy FRB show for Friday, July 17th. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.